Hello and welcome to yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 19th of February 2017. My name's TRP Watson. This week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James, Franco Malazzo and Nick from Partially Obstructed View. We're now going to talk about Anyone Can Whistle at the Union Theatre. This is a musical with a book by Arthur Lawrence and music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. Back when it was first done, this musical ran for, 9 performances and 12 previews in 1964. It happened to be Angela Lansbury's first musical stage role. She played the part of the mayoress, Cora Hoover Hooper, along with Lee Remick as Nurse Faye Apple and Harry Guardino as Hapgood. In this production, directed by Phil Wilmot and orchestrated by Don Walker, Nurse Apple is played by Rachel Deleuze, Cora Hoover Hooper is played by Felicity Duncan, and Hapgood is played by Oliver Stanley. The idea behind this musical is that we are in an imaginary American town that's gone bankrupt. Its former major industry produced something that never wore out, so once everybody bought it, nobody needed to buy one again. And they need a replacement before the entire town goes into liquidation. And the mayoress, who is Cora Hoover Hooper, and her friendly neighborhood judge decide on a fake miracle. So they make a spring magically appear out of a rock. Everybody thinks it's a miracle, apart from the rather skeptical Nurse Apple, who runs the local lunatic asylum, which is known as the Cookie Jar. John, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
It is quite a task to describe and then criticise this production, because the two things are quite separate. There is the show, written in 1964. Sondheim would have been in his early 30s, partnering with Arthur Lawrence. They didn't agree over very much as far as the book and its intermeshing with the lyrics was concerned. In fact, I believe there was a fist fight at one point, but I can't find that detail on the internet at the moment. But it's a show that can't make up its own mind about what it's about, whether it is a political satire. When it came to the Bridewell in London in 2003, the reviewers then said, oh, it's all about corruption and grift in American politics. It must be about Clinton. Well, you can guess what they might be saying who it's about today, although you know, nobody on this podcast is going to mention, don't mention the name. But I don't think it is really. I think it was spoofing anything. It was spoofing our town and small American drama. And it's just done so badly that there is no fit between the book and the music and the lyrics. And although you can hear, not echoes, but pre-echoes, if you like, of what Sondheim would eventually develop as better melodies, better harmonies, better lyrics in his future writing, this feels very experimental. And I think it might have been Michael Billington who said it was something written by bad writers on good drugs, or good writers on bad drugs, or something like that. But it certainly underlines what I say about Sondheim, is that he is in some ways almost schizophrenic, that he has this kind of tuneful, romantic, sardonic box out of which he pulls Follies and Company and work like his lyrics for West Side Story or Gypsy. And then there is what I call the tuneless, discordant, bonkers box, where I really think he was drinking the bong water when he produced things like Anyone Can Whistle or Sunday in the Park with George. However, let's look at this production. Bare stage, very small band, very, very enthusiastic, well-drilled, well-choreographed bunch of young performers who are mostly straight out of drama school or in their second job or something like that. Some good picks there, some promising-looking, very, very keen young performers. And four leads who are also not tremendously well-known either. I had not identified any of them as being a star of anything else I'd seen, even on the fringe. And the lady who plays the lead character, Cora Hoover Hooper, mayor of this small town, Felicity Duncan, I think she's called. No idea where she came from. Very statuesque, very solid lady, not very tall. An unusual choice for a lead which has previously been played by, as you mentioned, Tim, Angela Lansbury. I think it was Paula Wilcox when I last saw it at the Bridewell in 2003. I'm not sure whether having somebody different in that role would improve this show, because she gives it a lot of attack and she has plenty of humour. But she's not a mover, so in the dance routines, she has to be kind of helped up a set of steps to sort of watch the proceedings from the side rather than taking part, as I know Wilcox did when she did it. There are some good songs in it, but they don't, what's the right word? They don't feel part of a narrative musical. Maybe that's because I know them from Side by Side by Sondheim, because there won't be trumpets and Anyone Can Whistle were both excised from this show and achieved quite a lot of popularity in Side by Side by Sondheim. I don't think There Won't Be Trumpets is done very well in this production, but Anyone Can Whistle, it's a duet in which one of the partners is silent. So the nurse sings it to the young person she thinks is a doctor in the sanatorium. I thought she did that very well. She does it very reflectively and very softly, and it had a layer of interest for me that I hadn't seen in the song before. But beyond that, I think really I ought to let Gareth have a go at it, because I can't think of anything positive to say about the production. A lot of people, well, a number of people left in the interval of press night last night, and that could be because, even on a cold day in February, that theatre is just so overheated. But also, I think it's because they were bored. Gareth, you went to a different performance from me, so tell me what you thought.
Well, I went the night before, so I went to the last preview, and it was sweltering in that theatre, and it really doesn't help you enjoy a show when it's stifling and airless. So I'm sorry, Union Theatre, but you really need to do something about that. I think to put it into perspective, this was actually only the second show for which Sondheim wrote both the music and the lyrics. He'd written the lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy, and then he'd done Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and then he did this. And it, of course, was his first flop, as you said, Tim. It only had 21 performances, of which 12 were previews. My view is that its lack of success had more to do with Arthur Laurent's story stroke book than it had to do with Sondheim's music, although I'm not saying it's a good score. But I think the point is here, what we have here is we have someone learning his craft. It's the work of a novice. And I think it's quite interesting to see somebody's early work, to see where he goes. But it's not fully fledged Sondheim. This is a guy, albeit in his 30s, learning his craft. I think the story and the book are really not at all good. I mean, I think that's the problem with the piece. And Phil Wilmot's production just turns it into a romp, really. And I mean, we can accept, that 50 years ago we were allowed to say that lunatics were cookies. We're not even allowed to say lunatics now, but I mean, there were cookies who were in a sanatorium called a cookie jar. But this sort of whole thing, just the story, just is just hopeless for me, really. And I think, however good the music, and it isn't great music, however good the music, I think it's very hard to like a show or to admire a show that's got this sort of story and this sort of book. As far as the production is concerned, I actually felt it needed more restraint, really. I think that, he did make it a romp. The choreography is quite energetic, but sometimes becomes frenetic. And I think that it could have done with a bit more, not just the choreography, but the production could have done with a bit more restraint. The things that shone about it for me were, I thought the choruses were particularly good. I think the quality of the singing of the ensemble when they were singing together was very good, more so than when they were singing solos or as ensemble pieces. And I thought that some of the choreography was really very good. I mean, I even though it was incongruous, I thought it was actually rather fun to have a tap dancing scene with lunatics wearing silver bowler hats. And some of the balletic things were really quite well done in the choreography as well. And I thought it was a very good ensemble, although the four major leads didn't enthuse me that much. The two performances that I thought stood out for me were Rachel Deleuze as the nurse and Oliver Stanley as Hapgood, who's the new doctor, although we eventually realise he isn't the new doctor. And as John says, it's a very energetic and promising young cast who I'm sure, again, are also learning their craft in the show. So I think it's worth seeing if you're a Sondheim devotee and you haven't seen it or you want to see it again. I saw it at German. I did see the Bridewell Theatre production, although until John mentioned it, I'd forgotten I'd seen the Bridewell Theatre production. But I did see the 2010 German Street Theatre production, which had Issy van Renwick as a very cartoonish mayor. And when I was sort of reading about the show before I went, I mean, there were quotes from Sondheim. There was apparently point at which Angela Lansbury really wanted to pull out of the show. And she was saying that she felt her character was very cartoonish. And Sondheim's reaction was, well, they're all cartoonish. That's kind of the point. So having criticised Issy van Renwick for being cartoonish, it sounds as if she was actually being faithful to what Sondheim had written. But the most promising person in the German Street Theatre production was Rosalie Craig, who's gone on to do great things, and she played the nurse in that production. So I've seen it a few times. It's not a great show, but it's a curiosity, really. It will never get a major production because it doesn't deserve a major production. But if you're a Sondheim devotee, it's probably worth you seeing it. I felt the production itself was, you know, a bit ragged. It's not particularly nice to look at. There's no design as such, and it's not particularly attractive to look at. So there's quite a lot of things about it you sort of think, well, it's not great to look at. It's a bit sort of frenetic sometimes. And so there were quite a few things about it that sort of irritated me, although there were some good moments. There's a particularly good moment towards the end of the show where there's a kind of chase, a kind of on-foot chase, which he stages very cleverly to make it seem like there are a hell of a lot more people than there are in the cast by sending them out one exit and back of the other in a kind of loop. I thought that was very clever. But I think I couldn't recommend it to somebody who isn't a Sondheim devotee, really, because I think it might put them off Sondheim for life. But, you know, for me, worth seeing, I think.
There are a couple of anecdotal things about the production that you might like to include. I can't say the funniest thing about this show, but one of the most significant things about this show is how dogged it was with misfortune. And during one of the late rehearsals, a dancer fell off the stage and into the pit and killed a musician, which I think is a first.
Is this on Broadway?
Yes, yes. And one of the leading men, I think the guy who was playing Hapgood, an actor called Harry Lasco, had a fatal heart attack.
That's right, yeah.
And Arthur Lawrence said, we're just killing them off. It was a bit like, you know, when the guy falls down the stairs in The Producers, it's almost, you could almost make a show about the making of this show. And I did say earlier that I knew there was something about a fist fight, and I have found it. It was Arthur Lawrence, who was also directing the show, had a fist fight with the producer when he wanted to change the date of the opening. Arthur Lawrence wanted it postponed because of all the things that were going wrong, and they needed more time to bring it to press night, and the producer wouldn't let him. So there you go.
I hadn't realised Arthur Lawrence had directed it, and that tells you something, because I never think a writer and a director should be the same person, because you lose the kind of the creative tension that enables you to make cuts and do edits. Mm-hmm. If it's the writer and the director, they're just kind of blind sometimes to things. So that does kind of suggest that may be part of the reason why there was nobody critiquing the book and the story enough. Mm-hmm. I say story because I think it's original. It's not adapted from anything, is it? It's just an original story that Lawrence actually created, I think.
I don't know of another source, no.
Tim, the non-musicals Tim, made an exception for this. I forgot. My apologies.
It didn't put me off Sondheim, and it's something I have made it my task to go to any easily accessible Sondheim. Obviously, I could see it wasn't that good in terms of quality, and interesting to look up that the next full musical where Stephen Sondheim wrote music and lyrics was actually Company in 1970. He did Do You Hear a Waltz, which had music by Richard Rodgers in 65. And then it wasn't until Company that he did a musical on his own after this experience.
His first masterpiece, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Company. Because the funny thing happened to Waiting for Him was also a romp, and I've never liked it as much as a lot of people have.
The thing that most impressed me was the choreography, I think, in this production. I did find some of the singing a little bit, it felt a little bit muddy, and I don't know whether that was the oath of enthusiasm of the singers or just the whole concept of the play is so strange, or the musical is so strange that I didn't quite get it. I mean, I wasn't entirely sure about the whole setup to start off with. I slowly pieced it together throughout the early parts of the play. It becomes a lot clearer once Hapgood comes into it, and the cookies, as the insane people are referred to, are mixed in the general population and nobody can tell the difference. I thought it became much better then, and it is a lot more fun. I mean, you did feel that it could have done with a much bigger cast, because you kind of ran out of people to play. I mean, you've got to accept that you can't have that larger cast on stage at the Union, especially as in some cases they might actually outnumber the audience. I mean, we weren't, the night I went, I think we were in the audience were in the majority, but you know, if anybody had left at the interval, they wouldn't have been. So I think it's a a fascinating insight. I mean, you could certainly see the early parts of, you know, what Sondheim is going to become. And I have seen things like Company and some of his later work, Assassins and Sweeney Todd. So I can see where you're coming to with that sort of later Sondheim style. So I found it of interest from increasing my knowledge about Sondheim, and a decent production, although not a great one. It's not going to rescue this musical, I don't think, but I did enjoy my time there. We're now going to talk about The Glass Menagerie at the Duke of York's Theatre. This is Tennessee Williams' 1944 play, which is directed here by John Tiffany and designed by Bob Crowley. This production started life in 2013 in Broadway, where it had a cast of Cherry Jones as Amanda Wickfield, Zachary Quinto, Celia Keane-Bolger, and Brian J. Smith as Jim. It is presented here at the Duke of York's with Cherry Jones again, Michael Esper, Kate O'Flynn, and Brian J. Smith as the gentleman caller, Jim, again. And this play, a memory play, where Tom remembers his family. I mean, Tom is pretty much Tennessee Williams in this, and remembering his family, his mother, the faded Southern Belle, and also Tennessee Williams' older sister, who was called Rose, who had a botched lobotomy and lived for a very long time in a sanatorium. I mean, I think she didn't die until the 1990s. But here, the older sister is Laura, and she is lame and keeps dusting a sort of glass menagerie, a menagerie of little glass figures or little glass animals, her favourite of which is a unicorn. This has been done a few times in London, obviously, I mean quite a few times in London, it being a bit of a classic. Very famous production done in 1995, directed by Sam Mendes with Zoe Wanamaker as Amanda. More recently, 2007, The Apollo, Rupert Gould directed, Jessica Lange in it. Most recently in London, The Young Vic did a production. Joe Hill Gibbons directed Deborah Findlay in that. This production, The Duke of York's, is coming in from Broadway, where it received 7 Tony Award nominations. So it certainly appears to be something to look forward to. Franco, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I quite liked it quite a lot. I mean, the star here is Cherry Jones, who's not that well known on this side of the Atlantic, but is phenomenally well known on the other side of the Atlantic. And here she carries the main role of the matriarch incredibly well. And she enjoys it. You can see she can revels in it. It's the kind of role that a lot of people like Katharine Hepburn have done in the past, which is a woman of a certain age type role. And it's done fantastically well here. Brian J. Smith, he's only got a small part in this. He only comes on towards the end as a gentleman caller. But again, he lights up the stage when he comes on. Fantastic. He knows basically his role inside out. And you can tell that he's enjoying what he's doing. Michael Esper, this is the second time we've seen him this year. He was in the much maligned Lazarus, and he's much, you can see that, you know, he's on firmer ground here, and he's not the greatest Tom I've seen, but he's good in his role.
Gareth, what did you think of this?
I'm a bit cursed by having seen the Sam Mendes production, because it's difficult to live up to, really. And I saw the Rupert Gould with Jessica Lange, I saw the very misguided Young Vic production as well. So as much as I enjoyed it, I still can't wipe that production out of my memory, I'm afraid. I thought that Bob Crowley's set, his kind of impressionistic set, was stunning. It's beautifully lit by Natasha Katz. But I didn't actually realise what his design coup was until I walked up, because I was sitting in the front of the stalls, until I walked up to the stage afterwards to realise how he'd created this extraordinary design. I agree completely with Franco that Cherry Jones and Brian J. Smith, to me, were the stars of the show. And they've been with the production before Broadway, because it started at the American Repertory Theatre in Harvard. And they've been with it there and in Broadway and in Edinburgh and here. And I thought they were both absolutely sensational. Michael Esper didn't really do it for me. I'm not sure I entirely understand why, but I didn't feel he kind of inhabited Tom as I've seen it done before. And I felt that Kate O'Flynn just was sometimes too squeaky and overly fey, and she didn't, I'm afraid, do it for me either. So those two performances kind of weakened the impact for me. But having said that, I mean, it is, you know, it's clearly a very, very good production of a masterpiece. It's great to see it in the West End. And I was just thrilled to see Cherry Jones and Brian J. Smith. I mean, it is, you know, Jim is a small role. We only see him in the second half. But it is, you know, he completely lifted the play. And it is a very pivotal scene, it's a very important scene, but he really does kind of lift the play, I thought. So, you know, it's a very good Glass Menagerie, but sadly for me, I'm cursed by a definitive Glass Menagerie, which I don't think anything's ever going to live up to be honest. But I'd certainly recommend people go and see it, because it's quality, you know, it's quality stuff in the West End. Tim, you saw it.
I think I didn't get to appreciate the set quite as much as you did. I was right at the back, and back of the stalls, it all looked a bit shallow. Even the effect of it, they looked as if they were only doing sort of 6 feet of the stage, which was rather odd. And there was something that looked like a shark's fin lit up at the beginning, and I didn't understand that at all.
No.
So, you know, I did find that the entire design of it a bit shallow, and to a certain extent that also led to some feelings about the play. I wasn't as impressed with it as I have been. So I've seen all the most recent ones, and I think the Donmar still lives on in my memory. I think it's Ben Walden played Tom in that. And
Ben Chaplin?
No, Ben Walden.
Ben Walden.
Yeah, son of Brian. I believe. I mean, I've got, well, according to my notes, that's who it is, I think.
It was Claire Skinner, I think, as Amanda, wasn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, no, it was...
not Amanda, sorry, I meant Laura.
That one certainly lives on for me, but I saw that in the West End rather than Donmar. But that one certainly is something that lives in the mind, and that was the first time I saw this play and thought it was fairly magical. And oddly enough, the Jessica Lange one, which you would normally expect to be impressive, wasn't quite so impressive. I've seen her do other Tennessee Williams plays in the West End and has been much more impressive in other things. So, yeah, this one, unfortunately, I think I was just too far away to really catch the magic of this play, really. I felt distant from it. It wasn't that it was bad, it's just that it didn't thrill me as much as this play has sometimes thrilled me in the past. It didn't interest me, and I didn't really see what all the fuss about Cherry Jones would be. I mean, obviously, it is, you know, pretty much Amanda's play. It's not that it was in any way bad, but I didn't really get the specialness of it, which is a bit of a pity.
I don't think it's a spoiler to talk about the design a bit more, and because it sounds like you certainly didn't know what it was. It's inspired by a sculpture, the Statue Gallery by Richard Wilson, called 2050, which is a room full of used sump oil, which is perfectly reflective. And what you've got on the stage are two hexagonal platforms that sit on a liquid, I don't know what the liquid is, that covers the whole of the stage around it. And then you've got this stairway going down through one of the hexagonal platforms, which is an entrance and exit. And then you've got this impressionistic fire escape that rises to the heavens. So I, even sitting in the fourth row, didn't know that was the case until I stood up at the end and walked towards the stage and then realized actually what it was. So in a way, it's kind of a bit wasted on a lot of the audience, because you can't even see it from the front. You certainly couldn't see it from the back of the stalls, because I had a friend in the same theater, but not sitting with me, who was right at the back, and he couldn't see it either. But it is, you know, it's a very clever thing, but it was perhaps not really appreciated by everyone.
We're now going to talk about the Pitchfork Disney at the Shoreditch Town Hall. This is Philip Ridley's 1991 play, being given a rather, well, given that it's directed by Jamie Lloyd and designed by Sutra Gilmore, we think it's probably a fairly plush production. It stars Hayley Squires and George Blagden as the twins Presley and Hayley Stray, who live in a world of fantasy, trying to beat the outside world. Their parents left 10 years ago when they were 18, and they make up stories about a nuclear apocalypse happening outside, and they eat lots and lots of chocolate. Their life is interrupted by the entrance of Cosmo Disney, played here by Tom Rees-Harris, who bursts into their house and shakes up their life for a while. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I think actually one point to start with I would make is that he's actually invited into the house by Presley, and that's kind of the start of kind of the cocoon they've made of themselves breaking apart. And I saw this play about 5 years ago. It was the 21st anniversary production. And I really liked it then, and I really like it now. I'm finding it hard to kind of put one of the productions I've seen above the other because they came out pretty equal for me. It's Philip Ridley's first play, and there's a lot of his kind of trademark unusual, let's say, things. I think once you've seen enough of them, you start to count them off. I know I do. I when I do a review of them now, I make a list of the kind of common Philip Ridley memes. Chocolate very much stayed in his plays for a long time, and the eating of bugs, which is a major thing in this play. It's Cosmo Disney's big, it's his showbiz trick, which actually apparently is based on fact that there was someone Philip Ridley saw in a pub performing, eating kind of live cockroaches for cash, and he turned it into a character. I think there's probably a very terrifying list somewhere of how much of Philip Ridley is based on reality. It's a very hard play to describe because it's very hard to pin down what it's about. And again, I think this is, it's something that recent Ridley plays haven't been as much like. They've been a lot more specific, and it's much easier to see what he's trying to say. But I think also in these early ones where it's very kind of vague and cryptic what it's about, I think you can sort of project a lot of things on it. So they kind of feel always very topical. I think certainly with this one, there's kind of this fear of the world turning into a sort of a nuclear apocalypse. And the way that these characters have dealt with that is they've actually they tell themselves that it's already happened and they're the only survivors. And that's why it's such a big deal to have someone else come into the house, because it really kind of punctures the whole fiction that Presley and Haley live under. And also that what's happened is that Presley's seen someone, a very attractive man, and someone who possibly might be in some pain. And that's what's kind of made him go against his normal instincts and actually invite him into the house. But he turns out to be a very kind of abrasive character. And he also brings in, later in the play, the final character, who's called Pitchfork Cavalier, and is played by Sean Choate. And I don't want to say anything else about that character, because it's a major kind of, well, maybe a twist, maybe a kind of, it turns it into even more of a nightmarish situation than it is. And I think that's kind of the way to look at the play, is it does feel like being in a nightmare that feels like it's about to go out of control. And then a lot of it is about dreams and recounting dreams. I mean, one thing you're not going to get in this particular venue, it's in the basement of Shoreditch Town Hall, which quite a lot of stuff does get put on down there, and it's this whole kind of network of rooms down there, and they've chosen this one particular very, very long, narrow room, and it's kind of played with the audience in traverse. So what you won't get is a brilliant eye line at all times, wherever you are. Your sight lines are not going to be great. You're going to miss some things simply because you're going to have another audience member between you and if the characters are quite far up the traverse. But what you do get is a huge kind of intimacy and claustrophobia, which makes it a real pressured production. I think they're very, very strong performances from all four. They're really kind of well cast in this, and I think, you know, it's in a way, I think with Tom Rees-Harris, it's like the part was written for him, because he's kind of quite ridiculously pretty looking, but he's quite good at giving this menace underneath it that contrasts with the sort of the blonde and pretty innocence. Hayley Squires, I think she's not got a lot to work with. It's one thing about the character of Hayley is she spends most of the play asleep. But she does kind of make an impact in the few moments that we do see her. She's very kind of powerful, constantly arguing that she's in control and blatantly isn't. And the same is true of Presley. And there's a few scenes in there that George Blackton really kind of stands out in. And again, I would say, you know, Sean Choate really throws himself into the part, and I will say nothing more about it because it would be a spoiler. I mean, I was not a fan of the last few shows that Jamie Lloyd's been doing. I think he kind of had this on-off residency in the West End, and I think things kind of got a bit too big and showy, and it ended up with kind of, I mean, the Dr. Faustus that he did last year was kind of gibberish. So I think it's a good step to take this kind of step back and do something a bit more intimate, and also something I suppose that you can't impose so much of a high concept onto, because Philip Ridley is incredibly specific in what he writes. You know, he makes worlds that are very distinctly his own, And I think he's also quite particular about how they're performed as well. So I don't know that you've got kind of the amount of freedom that you'd have with something that's out of copyright, that you could just do whatever you liked with it. But I think it certainly in this instance, it's worked out, because this is a really strong production of it and really intense. And I think if Jamie Lloyd's acquired a following in the West End, and he brings some of these people to Philip Ridley, who's a writer who I think once you get into his style, he's someone I'm very enthusiastic about, but he does take a bit of convincing that he's going to be for you. I think it's great if we get kind of more fans in for his style, because it's something that you don't see a lot of stuff that's anything like Ridley at all.
I also saw the version at the Arcola in 2012. It starred Mirah Gale, Chris New, and Nathan Stewart Jarrett as Cosmo Disney. And I think the biggest contrast between the two of them is, in my memory, the Arcola production was slightly quieter. I found this particular production very, very shouty, and it was rather off-putting in many ways, that, you know, you just had these characters shouting at each other all the time, and I didn't get on with it as much as I did 5 years ago when I saw the previous production. I mean, it's still a decent play, and it's still a very interesting play. And as you say, it introduces you to a lot of Philip Ridley's habits and the things he likes to include in all his plays. I mean, this sense of an awful lot of his plays are set in some kind of post-apocalyptic world, and we don't always get to find out what the apocalypse is caused by or whether or not it's real. And certainly people coming into a haven from the real world and the real unpleasant world outside, and the disruption caused by people invading that. It's a rather fascinating play. And, you know, although I did have problems with the shoutiness of this production, I do think it's a good production, and I do think that they do the play well. And in fact, although I was aggravated initially by the shoutiness, I could see how well it fit with what they were actually saying, and I did question whether what is in my memory a quieter production in 5 years ago, whether that was in fact correct, because I would have thought that was, I do think on the whole I slightly preferred that one to this one, but this one is very strong, and it's certainly worth finding a way to Shoreditch and going to, I think.
Yeah, I think Mercury Fur is the only one that's literally post-apocalyptic off the top of my head. I think most of them kind of play with the idea of being post-apocalyptic in the same way that this does, where it's kind of a fantasy. But as you say, there's a lot of his plays that are about sort of outsiders coming into a safe haven. In Mercury Fur, there is an apocalypse, and we do know specifically what it is. And being Philip Ridley, the apocalypse is butterflies. I think you do see a lot of where he's going on from with this play, and I think it is great. To be honest, we can't really complain. If you're a Philip Ridley fan, you can't really complain. You get a lot of his work produced. Kind of for someone who, to people who aren't interested in theatre, would be a completely unknown name, he is someone we are quite lucky to get a lot of revivals of his plays. And of course he's prolific in writing a lot of new ones as well. So we can't really complain there, but I certainly think this will help continue that trend.
So Gareth, what did you think about the play?
I've never really understood the play, to be honest with you. It's all a bit of a mystery to me. So I'm kind of going to focus on the production, I think. I didn't see the Arcola production you've been talking about, but I was at the premiere of this production at the Bush Theatre back in 1991. And I think at that time, the phrase in-your-face theatre was kind of coined after this show, because it was one of those first of its type in a way, really. I find it very Pinter-esque, as it were, but it's got a lot less restraint and a lot less subtlety than Pinter. So I kind of nicknamed it Pinter on acid, really. What it's about is, as I said, a mystery. But, I mean, this is a great production. I think the site-specific nature of it works extremely well. I think sitting in quite a good place, so I didn't have too many sideline issues. I was sort of sitting in the middle of the space on a chair. I thought it did have an incredible atmosphere as a result of Sutra Gilmore's design and as a result of that kind of the basement kind of space. And I think the actors pacing and prowling the length of it was really quite effective. And at times, of course, they're incredibly close to you. And that really is kind of in your face, really. I thought that George Blagden was hugely impressive as Presley. There were moments where he was kind of shaking and sweating, and I mean, he really gave it his all, I thought. And of course, he does have to carry the play because he's on stage virtually all of the time. I find it very hard to take my eyes off Tom Rees-Harris as Cosmo, because he just, he's got an incredible presence, and it wasn't just because of what he was wearing, which was a sparkly pink or red jacket. He's just actually sort of mesmerizing and terrifying at the same time, really. And then, of course, we've got Soon Shoots Pitchfork, who kind of towers over everyone and everything, really, which I thought was a great performance. I think the problem with the role of Haley, which is, of course, played by a Haley, is that it's a bit underwritten, really. And I think it's hard for an actress to do well in an underwritten role. And I think Haley Squires does her best, really. So I, even though I'm not a sort of a huge fan of the play, I really like the production. I think it's great to see somebody of the calibre of Jamie Lloyd out there on the fringe doing stuff like that. And I think his next thing is somewhat, ironically, at the Bush Theatre as well. And I thought it was a perfect space, and I thought the performances were great. So, you know, whatever you think of the play, I thought the production was absolutely well worth visiting. And I think what was interesting is the people, it was a very, very young audience, and the people around were clearly, I think, seeing both the play and possibly Ridley for the first time. So I think that's great that it's introducing a new audience to Philip Ridley. So I'd recommend anybody going to see it, I think. Whatever you think of the play, I'd say go.
We're now going to talk about Sex with Strangers at the Hampstead Theatre. This is written by Laura Eason and directed by Peter Dubois. Laura Eason is an American playwright and has also written for things like the Netflix series House of Cards. This play stars Amelia Fox and Theo James. Amelia Fox plays Olivia. She is a talented, we are told, underappreciated writer who is stuck in a snowbound bed and breakfast in Michigan, not expecting anyone, and trying to finish her second novel. Her first novel was published, but ignored, and one or two people thought it was rather good, but it never really got anywhere. And now, over a decade later, she's writing her second and has arrived at this bed and breakfast to get away from it, and it's rather helpful, therefore, that she's kind of snowed in, and there's no Wi-Fi and no telephone either, so she thinks she can work in peace. Her peace is disturbed by Ethan, a young blogger who writes a blog called Sex with Strangers, where he goes out, picks up women, and talks about the sex they have afterwards and about the way that he picks them up and things like that. And he's very successful, but he appears to want to branch out into something else, into more literary publishing. And there is a split between his rather nice, hunky, intelligent persona when he's being personal with her and the sex hound, perhaps is the best word, that he portrays himself as when he is writing his blog. And I mean, that's a setup of this. And then really an awful lot of chat and an awful lot of, well, it's a way that Americans think about writers and talk about writers, especially in plays, you know, that they somehow have this magic to them. And the way they, often when they talk about writing and, you know, reading people's writing, it almost feels like magic. And I sometimes wonder what they're reading, because it always seemed to be very alien to me. And that's probably maybe because I'm a, you know, some kind of Philistine. But there's an awful lot of this that features this kind of what I associate with Americans, this view of the writer as somehow magical, and that everything that gets written is deeply incisive and deeply thought out and deeply intelligent. And I do try to keep up with books, and I sometimes read a book that people rave about and wonder what all the fuss is about. So it does feel very alien to me when they go on about the way that writing is, that writing is almost a magical thing and is so inspirational and so special, which is, you know, the large part of this play, I think. And it's a lot less cynical than the attitudes that I've seen elsewhere towards, you know, British novelists and British plays about British novelists, where they don't quite assign this specialness to the writing or the act of writing. So I was rather off put by this. I mean, there's certainly a lot of spark, but I don't think it's been well received by everybody else here. They are two attractive people. They do get down to their underwear and start fumbling with each other, and they do occasionally have pretty witty conversations, but I don't really know that this play goes anywhere, and it is unfortunately a mark of the way that most of the reviews haven't liked it, that the Hampstead have only got one review on their website, and normally, you know, if a play does well, they're putting all the 3- and 4-star or even 5-star reviews on the website and happily showing you them, and there's only one 4-star review here, and that's from the Times on their website. So I think that might tell you a little bit about the way that this play has been received. What do you think about it, Nick?
Much the same, really. I mean, and you're right, I think there are, it certainly feels very familiar about American plays and books and TV, I guess, that this thing of people talking about how amazing the act of writing is. It's almost kind of the characters and, by extension, the playwright kind of spending a couple of hours bragging about how many highbrow books they've read and how they've really got them. And, you know, so they're very clever because they read really highbrow books and understand them. And it is kind of a thing of that you do find sometimes writers, you know, it's a writer writing about writing and about telling you how amazing writing is and how amazing by extension she is because she's a writer. You know, it's hard to take too seriously because of that. You said about the fact that it doesn't go anywhere. And the trouble is it's very apparent early on that it's not going to go anywhere. So you do kind of tune out because you know this is just going to be a circular conversation. And it kind of plays with you a bit by looking like it's going to be a bit more interesting, as if Ethan, the younger character, has got some kind of nefarious plan to steal her book, but no, he doesn't. It's kind of a lot more romantic than it sounds. The title's kind of there to drag you in and get your attention. You know, the title, Sex with Strangers, but the play pretty much goes straight to the cuddling after. I mean, it's nicely performed, it's nicely staged, but for me, the problem is the script. It's just pretty self-aggrandizing about, well, I suppose not directly, but just in aggrandizing writers in general, it's self-aggrandizing. And it just kind of goes around in circles. And it is, you know, not necessarily getting what you expected from the title isn't, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. But it does feel like it's trying to sound like it's something edgier than it really is. And actually, it is just a couple of hours of people trying to have a fairly conventional relationship when they're introduced as people who are kind of opposites. And this should be quite an explosive relationship. And all they want really is something quite conventional and to sit around for hours talking about how amazing what they do is. I will say at least, because it's always kind of an eye roll when you read in the blurb of something that one of the characters is a really successful and rich blogger. They do specify that his blog got optioned for publication, and so he made a lot of money. And that is a thing that actually does happen. You know, you get Twitter accounts that get turned into books and TV shows. So I'm okay with that. It's kind of realistic. As someone who blogs, I find it frustrating when you've got things like Yerma last year and coming back this year, which obviously, you know, it deserves all the plaudits for Billy Piper's performance. But I was kind of sitting there frustrated about the fact that she was just kind of described as a blogger and that was her job. And I do kind of feel I spent like a lot of the play going, yeah, if you could make a living out of that, my life would be a lot easier. But yeah, so at least there's that, which I was like, okay, yeah, no, I've seen that happen, that, you know, people do manage to make money in that particular way. But again, I suppose it's not a good sign if that's what you're noticing rather than whatever they're actually trying to show you.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.